Okay.
That's a good way to end. Yeah. Q&A.
So for one question, I don't want to know about who is the, for first part, what is the book, who is the author?
For the first quote? Spanish or the English?
No, do you mean for the first quote? Yeah. The first one was El desgaste, desgarre, guerras. And that is actually, I was going to actually show an image really quickly. I'll show you her. Her name is...
English is not my first language, so I'm really hard to understand for Spanish.
Yeah, I can imagine. Although a lot of people, even for whom English is their first language, don't understand Spanish also. So you're in good company there. I know where it is. Okay. So that is from a small publication called La Unión de Jebas, I think. Jeba is like morra, if you know Northern Mexican Spanish. It's a Puerto Rican way of saying like badass woman, basically. And there were a number of contributions from folks in California and in Puerto Rico. And what I wanted to show you is, I think, let's see here. This is the person, Alexia Beitia Rubio, who wrote that line. She is a member of Antena Los Angeles, as it happens, and also a writer. And she is standing at the Antena Móvil at the Los Angeles Public Library, where we did a sort of a co-residency with Antena and Antena Los Angeles, which was part of the LA Public Library's amazing visualizing language project, which was part of Pacific Standard Time, this giant art thing that happens in Los Angeles.
Afterwards, yeah. We can write down all the references that you need.
Exactly.
If you need any book titles or names, we're happy to give them to you afterwards.
Yep. Yeah. Anyone else? Questions?
When you all did the exhibit at the Blaffer Museum, did you all curated all those books, the art? Oh my God.
Yes.
That's quite an endeavor.
It was. We worked with a really incredible curator, Amy Powell, and she was amazing to work with. We had done a previous installation at Project Row Houses in Houston, which is another important art space in Houston. And she had actually seen that show when we had done it, and she'd seen like a number of the pedagogical pieces that we had done. We had done a ton of programming at Project Row Houses as well. And she had seen that and then kind of wanted to bring it to Blaffer. And she was able to get a budget and also to support us. I think that experience was huge for us. It was a huge amount of work and we were incredibly ambitious and we burned ourselves out. And I think what one of the things that I realized was that museums have many departments. They have an education department, they have a docents, they have the installation department, they have often like writers and catalog writers on staff, there's the director, there's the people at the front desk, there's the curatorial staff, there's all these different groups. And once we kind of got in, we realized that as like what is sometimes called social practice artists, that we were trying to do everything, that every one of those, marketing and publicity, outreach, and that as artists, we had kind of taken on every single one of those roles that over the course of hundreds of years of museum history, they've divided into different departments with paid staff members, and that we, you know, and I think this happens to a lot of artists, right? Like you really care about your project and you really want to make it happen and you want it to be beautiful and you want it to be at the scale that it's going to reach people. And so you work and work and work. And I think for me, that experience was really important because it was kind of seen like, no. We're not going to do everything, right? We're going to, let's go a little bit slower. Let's slow down a little bit. And then also let's try and be realistic about like what we can do and what we can't do. In some ways, I think we just wanted to do everything and see how it all went. But I think that was a huge learning process as well.
I mean, there are a couple of things about that. One is that it was really important to us from the very beginning that when we were offered a platform, that platform was not right. only for us. Right. So it curated, there were 11 artists from different parts of Latin America and the US, and with a focus on local Houston artists. And it was really important to us to use that space, that part of Antena's work is recognizing those artists and seeing the ways that they're doing cross-language work and that is going to connect up with our work. And part of the work of Antena is identifying within all of these small presses, there were close to 180 presses represented in the show, and to really identify, like, these are the writers who are working in the between, like in the betweens that interest us. So that impulse, even if we, and also to do bilingual programming in a space that in a city in Houston, in a neighborhood that is largely Spanish speaking, had never done any bilingual programming. And so to bring folks into the museum who, in a welcoming way, who would never have had a welcome there. So those impulses, even if we did exceed our capacity in that moment, and our excitement sort of like sent us over the top in a way, the impulses remain in our work. Right. And many of the practices remain in our work. We're not, as I said at the beginning, we're not doing any of the same things that we were doing at Blaffer. But some of the kernels of what we did there have blossomed into practices that we're continuing to use. So in a sense, it's like we were on the right track, but we were going down the track too quickly in some way.
Yeah, I wanted to interject on one of the poems because I just had a quick thought. It's not a question or anything. I thought it was funny. I'm a comedian. I don't know if it's funny to y'all, though. When you're like Spanish and English, the same language. Mm. First thing that popped in my mind, I was like, yeah, they're both colonizing languages.
True.
And I wanted, and that's like immediately in my mind, I was like, fuck, I can't say that right now.
You know? Of course you can say that.
It's something we say all the time.
We think about that all the time, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. And I think, yeah, so one of the things that's happened over the course of this like language justice journey nationally is a lot of conversations around just what you're talking about. So what are the places of indigenous languages in language justice circles and in language justice conversations? And then also beyond that, what I need to come out of. Sorry.
Escape, maybe?
Escape. Not working.
¿Qué buscas? ¿Te lo busco?
No, este. Sorry. Command
tab. Oh, yeah. I love the command tab.
Command tab. Thanks. Because I wanted to show you on the. Oh, and I think my internet failed, but maybe I can still show you. Ah, yeah, maybe? No, it didn't go. So this one right there. So people have been thinking a lot about the place of indigenous languages within language justice conversations and circles and communities, and also the place of Afro-diasporic people within those conversations. Because especially in the South, a lot of this work has been about creating conversation, creating movement, and supporting movement between African-American communities, primarily monolingual, English-speaking, and Spanish-speaking communities, right? And so one of the things that in this podcast that's right there, it's called Se Ve, Se Escucha. I really recommend it. They have an issue called We Have Come This Far, which is all about Afro-diasporic folks within these spaces. There's a center for participatory change in Western North Carolina, in Asheville. And there's several compañeras there who have done incredible work. They organized a listening tour in Western North Carolina with different communities, with indigenous communities, communities that were indigenous there, and also migrant indigenous communities, because there's a lot of migrants from Mexico and from Central America that are going there that are speaking indigenous languages. So they went to communities to learn about the place of indigenous languages there. They went and talked to African-American folks about how to kind of build, right, with African-American communities and Spanish-speaking communities. And one of the things that's changed since then, and one of the things that they talk about in this episode, is about when you're setting up a language justice space, to be really clear that there's no language justice without racial justice, right? And that connection has to always be happening, right? And one of those things is also then, when you're setting up a language justice space or a multilingual space, to recognize that we don't all have access to the languages of our ancestors, right? And that's because of imperialism and colonialism and slavery and conquest. And so we have to kind of bring that up in the space and talk about it. And what they found in Western North Carolina and their organizing, and what we've also begun to see more of in Houston, is that when you do that and when you talk about that from the very beginning, right, like, it helps to kind of create a different space, right? Because it helps to create a space where folks, where we're recognizing the traumas that are in the room, we're recognizing what's been stolen, and it brings it to a level where it's like, how are we all going to be able to support each other to kind of move forward in this conversation? It opens it up, right? So it's not just about Spanish and English, these two colonizing languages. It's a larger conversation, but also like a lot of that is really nascent. It's really like those connections and that thinking is very much ongoing right now. But I really recommend that podcast. They have one show that's all in Ñañu, an indigenous Mexican language, and then this episode, which is talking with African-American leaders that are part of their community there in Western North Carolina.
And alongside that, not to in any way, I mean, I totally agree with everything that Jamie just said, but alongside that, there was a moment, there's a moment that really stuck in my mind when we met some artists from India, and they were talking about, we were talking about multiplicity of language, and they were saying like, yeah, on our bills, on our rupees, there, the words on there, like where it says $5 or whatever, there are 14 languages, but that's only a tiny reflection of the number of languages in India. And they were saying that, weirdly, the colonizing language, English, because Hindi has been so incredibly dominant in India, English is actually feels like a language of more commonality among people who are reacting to the dominance of Hindi. And it got me thinking a lot about ways to use the products of colonization or the products of oppression against the colonizers or against oppression, which many of us, or if not all of us, have experience thinking about that, obviously, and figuring out ways to do that, particularly those of us who don't have access to our ancestral languages, like this is the language we've got, right? And I've seen that also in other contexts. Just one other example, I'm going to Cuba next week to do an interpreter training and to interpret at a colloquium on indigenous language and preservation of indigenous culture in the Americas. So you can imagine how many people there don't share a language with one another. And so it becomes an incredibly important tool that many of them do share either Spanish or English, even though it's a problematic tool. And so I think that complexity of sort of like thinking critically about all the different facets of that, and how can we use, if English is one of the tools I have, how can I use my recognition, that tool, but also my recognition of English as a colonizing force and everything that represents, to also unsettle the dominance of English, which is one of the central questions that Antena looks at.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah. Amazing question.
Am I right that the Highland School in Tennessee, it has been doing civil rights training for decades, and like Rosa Parks studied civil disobedience there?
Yeah.
And so
yeah, MLK.
This guy's been on this path for a long
time. It's like 80 some years, yeah.
Yeah.
Because it kind of started like 30s and 40s doing labor organizing in the South with Miles Horton and Appalachian organizing, and then transitioned in the 50s into being a center of movement and civil rights education and training. So it was a space where Rosa Parks was trained, a space where a lot of other people were trained in organizing. And then in 60s and 70s continued in the civil rights kind of model, and then 80s, 90s, began to really think about language justice's place within those conversations as the South began to change through this large-scale immigration from Latin America. So yeah, Highlander Center is like a spiritual home for anyone who's doing this kind of work.
Mm-hmm. One thing I kind of grapple with as a writer is went to not necessarily code switch, but I like to infuse a lot of like Arabic names and Arabic words into my poetry and my fiction writing. And I always catch myself kind of it gets lost in translation.
Mm-hmm.
Just any thoughts about that? Because I'm like moving towards like, okay, I should just put it in the actual Arabic text. When it's a like a non-European language, it gets a little bit tricky to kind of stay true to the original language, so it doesn't get lost in translation.
Mm-hmm. Can I
translation
start?
And even like the transliteration of like Arabic to English doesn't as far it doesn't coincide. It's not cohesive. I don't know if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. And I'm so happy you asked that question because I had another comment to make in relation to this compañero's comment about colonial languages that I had forgotten to make. So thank you for bringing this up because one of the things that Antena thinks about a lot and that I also think about as a translator, we also do our own translation work unrelated to Antena, is when to leave something untranslated and when not to, and what all of the different kinds of comprehension, you know, like there's visual comprehension that I can look at the Arabic even if I can't read the word, or if I maybe can sound out the word, but I don't know what that word means. Like, that's a kind of comprehension. Or seeing an image, a word on the page that I can only read as image, and that being closed off to me as a non-Arabic reader slash speaker, that also is a kind of comprehension. Not understanding is a kind of understanding, and the fact that not everyone has access to everything is a hugely important idea in the world and in the work that we do. So one of the things that we think about sometimes, for instance, in the spaces that we interpret is how many languages are not represented by the interpreters. So like if you want to speak in, you know, whatever, in Arabic, and there aren't Arabic interpreters there and not everyone shares Arabic, that you could either just choose to let it be there and people won't understand it, or you could self-interpret, or the languages that aren't present because they're ancestral and we can't access them. And what I would say from a writerly perspective is you want to ask yourself how you want that piece to function. So if you leave a word or a line in Arabic script, there will and your but your text is primarily in English, there will certainly be readers of that text who can't access the denotative meaning of what you're saying. But maybe that's okay. Like maybe in that world, that's more necessary than providing some kind of a translation. There are lots of other ways to provide a translation. You could have notes at the end so that it's not interrupting the text. You can have a footnote on the page. You can have, if it's a fiction piece, you can have another character react to what was said in English in a way that like semi-reveals what was said. There's a lot of ways to think about it. Do you want to mention really quickly de la de cebolla in this context? Or not?
Yeah.
Sure. So there's a book that
actually, maybe at the end, like if the, once we run out of questions, maybe we podemos cerrar. Ah, no.
Oh, well, I wasn't going to read it. I was just going to talk about it. But do you want to just talk about how it functions?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. So this is a book that JP and I co-translated. It's by the Mexican Sephardic Jewish writer Miriam Moscona. She grew up, she's a Spanish speaker. She grew up in Mexico, but she grew up being raised by grandparents who speak Ladino or Judeo-Espanol, which is a language that arose or that developed when in the 15th century when the Jews were expelled from Spain and went to many places around the Mediterranean. And so that language has roots in Spanish, but has pieces of Turkish, Bulgarian, Greek, what else?
Hebrew.
Yeah, many. Yeah, my dad can also tell us lots of things about Ladino. This book is a book of prose. Miriam is primarily a poet. This book is prose and is written primarily in Spanish, but has a ton of Ladino in it, untranslated. And Spanish speakers, including us, when we were translating, we'd be like, oh, we got this. It's the structure of Spanish. The words, look, there's a lot of cognates. We got this. And then we would write to Miriam and be like, so this means blah, 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 right? And she'd go, ha, 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 ha. You think it does, but it does not. So, but in Spanish, you get more than an English language reader who doesn't access Spanish would look at the Ladino and just be like, ni idea, like no clue.
And in the original Spanish, she doesn't translate any of the Ladino. It's just there for Spanish speakers to work through however they can.
Or not, right? There's sometimes it's single words, but there are whole sections of this book written in Ladino.
Yeah.
And there are whole poems written only in Ladino because there's poems peppered throughout the book. So that's an option for any writer who's working with another language. What we decided to do in the English language version, because there are no cognates between Ladino and English, so we were like, okay, that's like even less access, is we did translate the Ladino. So this book is in English. The Spanish doesn't appear here. We translated the Ladino, but left the Ladino in black, and the English language translation follows it immediately and is in grayscale, so it's much lighter. So that the Ladino is privileged over the English, but the English is there because we felt that what was said in the Ladino, it would be too much of a hole in the book if that wasn't in the book at all. So there's, just to say, there's lots of different ways to think about that. But in our world, the more multilingual, the better. Like we would privilege multilinguality, multilingualism over comprehension.
We even have a small anthology of multilingual writing that was done 2 years ago in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. Called Reciclados Languages, then in Japanese, then Lenguajes Recycled, then in Chinese, with a number of different, Chinese yeah. too.
Yeah, there's some Chinese.
It's on the table too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. It was a great question. We have a little closing thing that we wanted to do, but is there any more? Are there any more questions before we cerrar?
What projects are you working on in the future? Like this enormous book must have taken a long time. This book that you did together.
This book.
Oh, that one.
Yeah. Yeah, we're done with this one.
right now, we're working on another co-translation of a Peruvian author named Giuseppe Campuzano. There's a book called El Museo del Travesti.
El Museo Travesti del Perú. Oh.
Yeah.
We talked about that a little bit.
The Travesti Museum of Peru. And we're also working on a compilation anthology of writings by Antena. So including the Dystopia Diaspora translation section, which is like 70 pages of translations, and a number of different essays, some of which have been published, the pamphlets, Taco Two Time, and a couple of other essays that maybe came out once online. Some of them have never been published. So we're trying to put together something like that for the 10-year anniversary of Antena in 2020.
Can you tell us a little bit about the pamphlets?
Yeah, let me just really quickly add a couple of the other projects that we're working on. The next iteration of Responder, por favor. So what's on your seats is the second iteration of Responder, por favor. The next iteration is going to be part of the Mexicali Biennial, which is a year-long intermittent show between Western Northern Mexico and California. So it opens, the first part of it opens next week at a museum at Cal State San Bernardino, and then the parts in Tijuana and Mexicali will be next year. So we have some work in that show that we're working on right now. Responder, por favor, version on the Antena Móvil. And then we're also at the very beginning stages of putting together an anthology on cross-language work, which as far as we know is going to be the only book that includes translators and interpreters and other cross-language workers. So there's plenty of really great anthologies of writing about translation. There are very few books about interpreting, but there are some. There's a lot of like technical books about interpreting, sort of like educational materials. But as far as we know, there's no anthology that pulls together people just thinking about language transfer. So that's another thing that we're working on.
And then really importantly, like the day-to-day work of holding together the collectives in Antena Houston and Antena Los Angeles is a huge part of our daily practice. So building those collectives, making sure that they're responsive to the community. Like this week in Houston, even as I've been away, we're interpreting 10 different events with 20 different interpreters coordinated, by Antena Houston, by the collective. So that kind of day-to-day work continues to be the base and the foundation for all of these aesthetic interventions that we're making. Like from the very beginning, it's always been like, we're doing this work in the community, and then Antena, which now sometimes I think of as Antena Air or Antena Aire, is kind of like this aesthetic space of experimentation and play. But without that base work and groundwork and community work, none of this really makes sense.
And you were going to talk about the pamphlets briefly.
Yeah, so the pamphlets are on the table. There's five of them. There's three manifestos. We wrote them in 2014 for the Blaffer installation. A manifesto for discomfortable writing. They're in English and in Spanish. A manifesto for interpreting as instigation, and a manifesto for ultra translation. There's a guide of experimental writing exercises called How to Write More, and a guide on language justice called How to Build Language Justice. All of those are available for purchase here today, but they're also available on our website as PDFs, which I won't be able to show you because my internet fell out, but Jen can.
I'm not going to. I was going to ask one of us to do the GIF and the
cool.
other one to do the image.
Okay.
Which one do you want to do? Say that again.
I'll do the GIF.
You'll do the GIF.
It's
so
not
I'm
going to
do this. And then you should, well, then we can read off this one. So we knew, as JP said, we knew that we would never get to everything. Anyway, but also especially structuring our talk in this way, where we were relying on you to direct us of what to talk about. So we made a map of what we do. This was actually just a draft, and then we ended up deciding that we were just going to use this for today. So it spins. We made a GIF. And then we thought we would just close by reading to you sort of how the universe of how we think about our work or what our practices are. So do you want to come over here and read, or do you feel like you can read off that spinning thing?
I should go over there.
So let's go always to the left.
Yeah.
I'll start here.
Okay.
So Antena Móvil.
Experiments and participatory research.
Installations.
Multilingual event organizing.
Sharing platforms and resources, editing and curating.
Collaborative writing.
Collaborative translation.
Performance informed by cross-language life.
Workshop facilitation and pedagogical experiments.
DIY bookmaking.
And then if we go into the middle here, it says, what we do not yet know how to do and may not even know the what of, but are moving toward opening.
Not to do and redo what works, but to reorganize and welcome what sparks.
Recognize.
And troubles.
And then on the inner circle, it says, living between languages.
Unsettling the dominance of English.
And radical listening.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.